Good morning. The word of the week seems to be complacency. However, Wayne Tuberty is determined to keep us on the straight and narrow.
I just get the sense about the place that maybe people are kind of fed up with the rules and they're kind of maybe throwing a little caution to the wind. And you can understand that, but it's dangerous to do that, unfortunately. And it kills me to say it because, God knows, I want to break all the rules. But we can't. And I've been doing something which I haven't done for a long time in the few weeks that this has happened. I've been reading a bit about it, a bit more, paying a bit more attention. I've been ignoring it a lot because it's too depressing. But I've been reading a bit about it. And if we break the rules, there'll be more. There'll be more death and there'll be more suffering and there'll be more sadness. So I'm just saying to you, and I'm saying it to myself, I'm thinking it aloud in some ways, we just have to keep going. And we have to stick by the rule. Listen to what Dr. Houlihan tells us on a nightly basis. He's not doing that for the crack.
He most certainly is not, because if Ryan is the carrot, Dr. Houlihan is the stick.
We clearly have the vast majority of the public with us. We've had our own sense, I think, from our own anecdotal experience in recent days that maybe we've seen a little bit of movement. We now have some evidence from some of those sources I've given you that in fact is the case, that we are seeing a little extra movement. People beginning, for understandable reasons, as I've said before, perhaps to feel like we might be on some kind of a pathway towards a slackening of measures on the 5th of May. That is not the case. As I said here yesterday evening, if the decision was to be made today, we wouldn't be advising that any of the restrictions that are in place be relaxed.
Dr. Houlihan has heard on Friday's Morning Ireland. So, are we really getting a little elastic in our movements? Here's RTE's science correspondent, George Lee, on the same programme.
Transport Infrastructure Ireland have measures of ways of counting traffic on main roads and on national routes, and they had done their analysis and they said that they felt that there wasn't any huge significant pickup in terms of people moving about, despite what people were saying, so that it was an indication that people weren't lifting the restrictions themselves. But what was produced in terms of the noises that we're making from the Irish National Seismic Network, who are measuring the movements that people, human-made sounds, the vibrations that makes in the ground, really, really sensitive stuff. And it just caught us out in terms of, you know, for 3 weeks it was very clear that the level of activity in terms, because when you move and when you drive a car or get on a train or start a business or anything like that, or an industry, you're creating vibrations, and when we're walking we create vibrations. And it's very clear for 3 weeks they were on the floor, they were down about 75% from the moment that the restrictions were imposed, and suddenly they've jumped up in the last week. And so the noises are telling them that we are definitely relaxing ourselves, or some people are, in terms of their movement, and they're worried about that.
And it seems our numbers are still too high.
They presented last night a lot of a new analysis, some new graphs in relation to what Professor Philip Nolan and his team are looking at. And it became very clear to me in speaking with him and listening to him that he's looking at, and his team are looking at, these numbers on a daily basis. And I think that they're getting particularly concerned that people are far too casual about what they're looking at. He presented one particular graph, which was a comparison of the total number of cases being detected per day, correctly apportioned to the days in which the tests were taken. And also those in the community for that, and those in nursing homes for that. And it was very clear, a pattern there was that the community was 2 weeks ahead of the nursing homes. So the community had the disease first before it moved into nursing homes. But one of the things in it is that the levels of cases that they're finding in the community is working at around 500 per day, and the ones in the nursing homes are up around 100 per day and rising. And that is just far too high. He said that in areas where they're considering relaxing and have begun to relax some of the restrictions, they're down at around, you know, kind of tens. You know, they're down around 23 in Norway. They're down around 77, I think it is, in Austria, down around 12 or so in the Czech Republic.
And these are countries with bigger populations than
bigger
us.
Population. And the big fear then is that this is really contagious. When you see what happened in the nursing homes when they began to look, there's much more of it in the nursing homes than we would have known only about even late last week. So it's highly contagious. It's still there. There's too much movement. And they're saying that once there's movement like that, this thing will spread. And at the moment, what we have done is buying that time to put in place better preparations in the health service, but that the disease is still there, and if we let up, we're going to be in trouble.
George Lee on yesterday's Morning Ireland. On Liveline on Thursday, Mark phoned in. He had contracted COVID-19 and, frankly, he was lucky to be alive.
Your recovery is so remarkable that the hospital have asked you, can they release your medical records for research purposes?
Medical records have been released to every medical board across the world. See, what happened to me was, and my wife will know much more about this, but what happened to me was, I got the COVID, it was bad, it was double pneumonia, double COVID pneumonia in the lungs, right? Mm-hmm. They were very bad, but I got a blood clot, it attacked the small bowel, it went ischemic, it was dead, and that was the trouble. They couldn't take me away to operate because I was so sick, I wouldn't have lasted. So the 2 miracles where I had to fight to survive to get some form of, you know, life back to the bowel, so uh-huh. that they could operate and hopefully, and also that the COVID would leave me, do you know, the kind of way.
Yeah, so you went into bowel failure.
Bowel failure.
As well as your lungs being ravished.
Exactly, yeah. And at one point I was on the verge of multiple organ failure.
Okay, and you're back home now. You're back home.
I got out of ICU two weeks tomorrow, and I walked out 6 days later out of hospital.
It's incredible.
Unbelievable.
And Joanne, Mark's wife, told Joe just how serious the situation was and a phone call she had received from the hospital.
That's when the nurse turned around and the tone was completely different. They asked me, did I have somebody with me?
Oh.
And then I knew. I just started screaming, please just tell me he's with us. Please just tell me he's with us. And she said, I need to put the consultant on the phone to you to speak to you. And I said, no, I don't want to speak to the consultant. I know what that means. I'm not stupid. Just stay on the phone to me, nurse. And because I had got to know her over the course of the, you know, a couple of weeks that he was in. And she said, I can't. This is not my part of my job. Yeah. I need to put you on to the consultant. So the consultants came on then and just told me there was basically nothing that they could do for him.
Okay.
So I said, is he going to die? And they said, it's not looking good. And I said, I just screamed and roared, I need to see him. I need to see him.
Yeah.
And because I hadn't seen him in over like 2.5 weeks at this point, so they turned around and they said, we're allowing you in.
Okay.
We're allowing you in. He was COVID-free at this point.
Right.
We're allowing you in to say goodbye. We're allowing the children in to say goodbye. We had a Garda escort, 160 miles an hour in the road. Mark would have loved us.
Yeah.
He would have loved us. His dream come true. But it wasn't funny to us at the time, obviously. It was just so surreal. But they rushed us in to say goodbye to him. He was offered his last rites. And it was just absolutely horrific.
All of which makes Mark's eventual recovery quite remarkable. But the trauma will stay with Joanne for a long time to come.
If you saw it in a movie, it's just, you wouldn't believe it. You would think it's, oh, come on, that's so far-fetched. He's in a coma. He's not coming out of it.
It's a disease for which there's no vaccine and no cure.
Absolutely. He was in double organ failure. His lungs had failed him. His bowels had failed him. And when he heard his children, he opened his eyes. The nurses were a witness to that.
Okay.
And I was just so proud of him.
So were you
proud of Mark.
Were you back home waiting on another call or did you stay in the hospital?
Yes, I am.
Dreading another call.
Oh, dreading another call.
Yeah.
Dreading another. No, literally, I'm changing my ringtone because every time the phone rings now, I still get that rotten feeling.
That's incredible.
That of bad news, it's surreal because you just don't want the phone to ring.
Joanne and Mark Burke on Thursday's Liveline. But more and more we're coming back to the importance of testing. Professor Luke O'Neill, immunologist at Trinity College, spoke to Mary Wilson on Wednesday. He believes we need a minister for COVID-19 testing.
Look, let me ask the stupid question here. Why is testing so complex?
Well, first of all, it's so important. That's the first thing to say, right? As we've all said, the WHO have it as number one. And before you can loosen up, you've got to have massive testing in place. And then contact tracing, Mary, is part of this as well, obviously, which in itself is complicated. We need to take on 5,000 extra staff to contact trace, for instance. Now, a minister would have the power to maybe redeploy staff, to make sure the funding is there to support this, talk to suppliers to make sure the best possible kits are there. So it's a very complex thing in a way.
Why is contact tracing such an important element here?
Well, remember, we protect our population through this. In other words, let's say we loosen up the lockdown at some point. Who knows when a big loosening will happen? And then we let people back out again. The risk is that the virus is still lurking in the community somewhere that we haven't managed to eliminate it completely. Someone gets infected, you identify them with a test, and then you immediately isolate all the people who they've been in touch with. If you like, it's a more limited type of lockdown, only for those who've been infected or come in contact with someone who's infected. But they may have had contact with 20, 30, 40 people. So therefore, you need these extra people to go in there and contact all the people who have been in connection with the person who's infected. We were doing this about 2 months ago, as you may remember, yeah. It began. But now it has to ramp up hugely.
But if we were told last week the reproduction rate had been reduced to 0.7.
Yeah.
Do we need all this contact tracing?
That's the joy of it. If it goes below one, we're laughing our heads off because then it will gradually disappear. The risk is it goes back above one because now it starts to spread again. That's the biggest fear we have. And then you're in a rebound situation. And then the horror and unimaginable prospect of having another lockdown. In Singapore and Japan, they've seen a second sort of slight blip now because there were pockets of infection there that have now suddenly started to spread again. So the issue, you hit them in the head. If we can keep it below one, we're fine. But the risk is it'll go above one and then we're back into trouble again.
Immunologist Professor Luke O'Neill with Mary on Wednesday. Oh, and by the way, Chinese researchers reported 33 strains of coronavirus. What does Professor O'Neill make of this?
That's another example of bad science, Mary, in a sense. I mean, that was rushed out, wasn't refereed properly, big headline. The evidence in that was very scrappy, I think. And we've got to be on our guard the whole time to read this stuff very, very carefully. And sadly, that study, in my opinion, didn't really cut the mustard.
Well, that's a relief. Let's swivel then from bad science to the downright silly.
This is what happens when you find yourself self-isolating or whatever it is you're doing. The effect of social distancing. This is what happens.
Marty, forgive my madness, but this is Donald Duck starting his car on a pink moon morning.
Oh, that's brilliant.
Oh, it's something, all right, Marty in the morning. And lest we forget,
wash your hands. 5 for 5 fingers, 1 for 1 hand, 5 for the other 5 fingers, 5 for your first hand, and then 1 for the other hand. 5-1, double 5-1, wash your hands. It's simple as that.
10-4, back in a bit. Welcome back. Ooh, this pandemic. It's a good job. It's a once-in-a-lifetime event.
You've good days and bad days, haven't you? And I think we're all sort of fed up now, aren't we? The novelty is worn off. And all the firsts are gone and we realise that this is what it is and we want shot of it. And it's just getting in on a lot of people.
That's the Darcy for you. How is the Tuberty doing?
Comes and goes in waves sometimes. Occasionally there's a little existential wobble. Like, what the hell is this thing? What in the name? And then it goes and you go, okay, well, that's what it is. Now I need to confront it and get on with it. Do you ever get that? What? It's almost you're going along normally and then like in a movie you go slow motion. But this couldn't be happening. Some bread please, could have some sausages, yes. And you're fine then.
Fine, absolutely fine. Hanging on by our fingernails, but yes, fine. However, for one Kerry listener, there was a certain salve to the week. Because they had made the essential journey to Daly's Super Value in Killarney. They'd got the bread, they got the milk, they got the cheese and, ooh, pack of potato. And a €9.7 million lotto ticket. Gavin Jennings tried to wheedle some information out of store manager P. PJ McGee.
Often when we speak to people after a big lottery win, when people are trying to figure out who's won, you kind of look around to see if anybody is, well, acting a bit rich. That's a bit hard to do at the moment, isn't it?
It is. Hopefully it's a syndicate that at least it would be evenly spread out. Hopefully it'll make life a bit easier for people when we get through this.
So anybody coming in with big smiles on their faces in the last few days?
Not at the moment.
Anyone trying to hide a big smile with a mask?
No, it's just all ourselves and, you know, the team here in the shop are having a... there's a good atmosphere. It's instead of talking about the other thing, we're talking about that, you know.
Well, later on the news at 1, Joe Stack went to Killarney on a fool's errand to get anyone from Kerry to tell you if they'd come into money.
Are you here to collect 9.7 million euro?
No, very doubtful I'm only here from my bit of morning shopping because I didn't do it, regrettably.
Any idea around Killarney who's after winning nearly 10 million euro?
No idea. Somebody nearby, I presume with the corona pandemic, is probably someone nearby. I wish him all the best.
Are you here to collect 9.7 million euro?
I wish I was. I think it's marvellous for the store after they're having their lucky one on Tuesday as well.
Great for the locality. Any idea around Killarney who's after winning 9.7 million?
Well, personally myself, I don't actually know. I actually couldn't tell you actually who's after winning it.
Good for the town?
Great for the town. Fantastic. In these times anyway, it's great, isn't it? It's great to see some money being around the place.
Tuesday's news at 1 and the very best of luck to whoever did win it. But while Kerry's economic stock may be rising globally, well, we're in a bit of a pickle. On Tuesday, the Department of Finance released a report looking at the state of our finances. And on Wednesday, Gavin Jennings spoke to Alan Barrett, director of the ESRI, and this, deep breath, is how he started the interview.
A deep recession, different to recessions we've lived through in the past, not because we borrowed too much or spent too much, but because of the cost of a pandemic. With around 1 million workers depending on state benefits this morning, and no clarity over how long more they'll need help or can't work, the Department of Finance is forecasting that the economy will shrink by 10% this year, that unemployment could rise to as much as 22%, and the gap between what the country makes and what it spends will grow to 23 billion euro this year.
There you be. Best get it over with, I suppose. But this new forecast puts pay to any hopes we might have harboured of a rapid recovery. Here's Alan Barrett.
Even a number of weeks ago, we were clinging to the hope that we would have what's known as the V-shaped recovery. So the idea was that the government, essentially for good public health reasons, had almost turned off large sections of the economy. So you had this dramatic downturn in economic activity. And there was kind of a hope that the activity could be turned on relatively quickly and that you'd get that bounce back and the famous V-shape. The department, and they explained this very, very well in the document, are now moving in the direction of saying that that bounce back is simply not going to happen. And I think collectively, across the population and into the economics profession, there's this real realization now that things will not be turned on anytime soon. And even as the Taoiseach was discussing last night, we are going to have this sort of gradual lessening of restrictions. They're, feeding into their forecasts this delayed turning on of the economy. And that's why you're getting a sort of a much starker picture from them than would have been previously the case.
And how in hell might we possibly get out of this?
Is it possible, and how is it possible, to keep going and recover and not increase taxes or cut spending on welfare and health, for example?
Well, it's all a question really of duration. If this thing, even if you look at the Department of Finance figures, and if there's a sense that by sort of 2021, so in a year's time, that the economy is recovering, well, as the economy recovers, more people are going back to work, so the welfare bill goes down, and more people are working, so that, you know, the tax take goes up. So the natural operation of the economy will work in such a way to start reducing that enormous deficit, and that will have to happen. The difficulty, of course, is if this goes on for an awfully long time, then you're borrowing, and that is not sustainable, ad infinitum or anything like that.
Alan Barrett of the ESRI. And on that same programme, we heard from the man himself, Minister for Finance, Pascal Donoghue. And this is how it started.
How big a mess are we in?
Every so often you'd love a bit of the sugarcoat, but no. Anyway.
How long do you believe it will take to get back to where we were pre-corona?
Well, in some of the questions that I dealt with yesterday when I published the document outlining where we are, I said that I believe later on this year, if and when we see progress from a public health point of view, And if and when decisions can be made in the way the Taoiseach outlined last night, I believe we will see an improvement in economic activity in the second half of this year. And I believe the peak unemployment that we're likely to see of approximately 22%, which is a horrific figure, given the scale of loss this means for those who were at work and indeed some who are still at work. But I believe that figure of 22% will go down to an average of around 14% for the year. So a significant decrease versus where we are now, but still too high. And I believe as we go into next year, we will continue to have over 2 million people at work in our economy, and we can get that unemployment rate down again. So we can and we will make progress in rebuilding as our public health allows us to do so.
That's one scenario. The other scenario is that people won't be able to go back to work in the numbers that we hope or expect, and that it could take longer to find, for example, a vaccine or a cure. What would happen then?
Yes, that is one scenario, Gavin. You're correct. And what I am doing and what I've done is I've outlined different scenarios depending on where we are with testing, depending on where we are with the spread of the virus and disease throughout our country. So what would that mean? If that were to happen, it would mean that our deficit, the amount of money that we need to borrow, could go up again by the end of the year. It could go up because it takes longer for our unemployment rate to go down and because we need to make further economic decisions. The second thing that it would mean is the reduction in unemployment that I believe we will achieve, that could take longer to happen if things turn out differently with our public health. But what I would say in relation to that scenario is the foundation of where we want to get to with our economy is confidence in public health in the first place. And if things do change in relation to the virus and our ability to combat it, because of many of the strengths that we still do have in our economy, we will still be able to get to a place of employment and income growing again. But if the virus takes longer to contain, it could take longer to get there.
Finance Minister Pascal Donoghue on Wednesday's Morning Ireland. However, one thing is for certain, this is a global pandemic with global economic consequences. And just how bad a state we're all in financially can be illustrated by plummeting oil prices. Here's markets analyst Paul Somerville with Sean O'Rourke on Tuesday.
Donald Trump, always looking at the bright side, says great time to buy oil. They'll pay you to take it away and, you know, we'll provide the storage.
Well, anybody who followed Donald Trump's advice for the last 10 days has actually probably gone bankrupt in the oil market. It's absolute carnage in this oil industry total, and even this morning. So when we hear about oil prices, people get a little bit confused because there's different types of oil prices in the market. So the main ones are Brent crude oil that we know in Europe and then West Texas oil. So all the fun was in the West Texas oil contract yesterday, trading of the front month contract. The front month means the most traded contract. Now, that is due to expire today. And basically, when speculators and hedge funds are in that contract, they don't want to take physical ownership of the oil. They're betting on the price of oil going up. So what they need to do is sell out of that contract before the expiry. But there was literally no buyers in the market. So oil prices fell 300% yesterday alone. Now, most people listening would say, how can something fall 300%? Obviously, it could only fall 100%, then it goes to zero. But in the futures market, you can have negative pricing. So the price of oil fell from $20 a barrel to negative $40 a barrel yesterday as these speculators were trying to get out of their positions before expiry because they don't want to take delivery of their oil. There's nowhere to put the oil because storage in Oklahoma is full. And basically, we're going to see some hedge funds that have actually gone bankrupt overnight.
However, this is a complex situation and there may just be the sliver of a silver lining.
Oil prices across the globe are falling, and that is basically because we're having a deflationary implosion in the whole world. The global energy glut is coming, and there's nobody to use this oil just at the moment because obviously of coronavirus, but it's not as simple as coronavirus. This is all about central banks that have been propping off shale gas, lending the money. The Federal Reserve is now in buying corporate bonds of the shale gas industry in the USA. They are saying that it's to prop up the economy, but they're literally buying junk bonds. So it's very very, very complex exactly what's going on. But for the EU consumer, it's actually quite good news, because for us, you know, the EU, we're a big importer of oil, and we should see much lower oil prices eventually at the pumps.
That was Paul Somerville with Sean O'Rourke on Tuesday. And this week also saw new rules banning any gatherings of more than 5,000 people. And just like that, sporting, arts and music events for the summer just disappeared. Listowel Writers' Week, though, featured on Bowman on Sunday. Here's Brian McMahon speaking in 1971 on what it is that impels people to write.
If you go to Ballybunion, and if you crouch down, and if you take up a fist of sand, and if you drop it, and if you examine each individual grain of sand, and if you examine the individual grains of sand on every beach in Ireland and in the world, you will find to your astonishment that they are each is completely identical, separate, and is unlike every single grain of sand in the world. The same has been true of leaves of trees, and the same is possibly, most likely, overwhelmingly likely, true of human beings. That the omnipotent being has never created any two people exactly alike. And this leads to identity, and this leads to individuality, and this kind of individuality is a kind of sanctity or holiness, which it always affects me profoundly. I have said it before that when I approach any person, I say, you were never created before, you will never be created again, and this kind of observation, this kind of thing is, I find tremendously moving. Now, this is the basis of whatever tin pot philosophy I have towards writing. The second thing I will say, that I recognize that there are three great hungers in the human being. There's a hunger which is called the spiritual hunger, there's the physical hunger, and there's the imaginative or the cultural hunger with which we are dealing mainly here this evening. So this condition of distinctness, this condition of uniqueness needs to be somewhat described and laid down. And the tools that you use to do these things are words. And words are pretty powerful things. Because a man can lose or gain a major election by the selection of three words. They are tremendously powerful weapons, and they should never, never be forgotten.
And he goes on to say that it is the words we use and how we use them that determines, well, everything.
Words are tremendously powerful, and they're expressed popularly in the great bank of say. What people say, how people describe things. So you would need to have an ear for what people say, because some of the people you're speaking to are aborted dramatists, unreal lives novelists, and undergraduate poets. There are more of these in the country than one thinks.
Brian McMahon at the inaugural summer school in Listowel in 1971, as heard on Bowman on Sunday. And a man who listens intently for the word idly spoken, the fudge, the meander, the sidestep, or the downright deceitful is Sean O'Rourke, who on Wednesday, just before he went off air, brought us this.
And now for some personal news. For nearly 7 years now, it's been my great privilege to sit in the best current affairs chair in Irish broadcasting. But nothing is forever. I'm going to be 65 in May, and that'll be as good a moment as any to end the great adventure of Today SOR. I've had an absolute blast. Daily interviews about the stories of the day, debates, elections, referendums, a memorable encounter in Doonbeg with Donald Trump, some great music and song, and the odd bit of hand-to-hand combat in studio. All of it with a light dusting of fun, as we promised you at the very start, and all made possible by really hard-working, talented and loyal colleagues to whom I will be forever grateful. They really are marvellous public servants. Today with Sean O'Rourke will end on Friday, the 8th of May.
Well, whether it be on the News at One or his own programme for the past few years, you'd be salivating waiting for Sean to take a politician to task or relieve the judicious silence that lured the unsuspecting to drop, like a stone, through his trap door. Sean O'Rourke will be sorely missed. Back after this. Welcome back. Sally Rooney's novel Normal People has just been made into a TV series directed by Lenny Abrahamson, and Lenny spoke to Sean Rocks about the two main characters, Connell and Marianne, and he talked about how he wanted to portray the love affair between them, a relationship that starts in school and continues into adulthood.
What feels radical about it is that what we're doing is we're tracking this time between them from when they sit down and start talking to each other to the point where they're making love. And I don't make any distinction in how I shoot those different parts of the encounter, because they're all part of an unfolding conversation and communication between them. And so I think what happens often is that, and we'd be used to this from, you know, movies and from maybe more old-fashioned sort of telly, is that there's a look between two characters and next minute there's the sex scene, and that's done all very, you know, in quotes, tastefully, with lots of, you know, silhouette and shadow and everything. And it's a bit like, sex scenes in that context are a bit like, you know, car chases or, you know, gunfights. They have their own, apparently they have their own rules. And we just didn't want to do that. We wanted to be as candid and as present as possible and continue our investigation of these characters through that part of their experience. So, like, it's the faces of the characters that I'm primarily interested in. I'm not deliberately framing out the bodies, because that then becomes kind of coy or, you know, just something cheesy about that. But it's just an honest attempt to express what's happening between them. And I think that also, for the actor's point of view, it just meant that nothing was gratuitous. Like, you know, we weren't, it's just part of the story and it's a vital part of the story. And we're all collaborating to try and represent that aspect of their lives as kind of beautifully, mostly, as we can.
Lenny Abrahamson on Arena, bringing Sally Rooney's Normal People to the small screen. So, are you Zooming? And if so, are you attempting to put your best self forward? If so, rest assured, it's nothing new. Sinead Rice is the head of education at the National Gallery of Ireland, and she spoke to Ryan Tuberty about the art of the portrait.
But you know, the Zooming thing that you've been doing with your colleagues, and as we've been, I've been doing with friends, is it's kind of a portrait of sorts, isn't it? When you look at your friends and see what's happening behind them, you know, the way
it
portraits. When I look at a portrait, for example, in a gallery, I'm nearly always looking over the shoulder to see what the artist has chosen to include from the person's life.
Oh, yeah. And I mean, there's loads of talk about that online at the moment. You know, there's a trend now for people positioning themselves in bookshelves.
They're curating their... Yeah.
Curating their Zoom. Exactly. Well, I mean, all of that is about curating. Like, everybody does it, intentionally or non. We think about how do we look? What's the angle of our face?
Yes.
Like, when we're talking to somebody, what can you see behind us? And, I mean, obviously, incidental things happen, but usually we're positioning things. And with portraiture, that's absolutely the case. So we have portraits in the National Collection where they are full figure and you're getting to learn a lot about the person in terms of who they are and what their role is by the objects that are included or by kind of key little clues that are in the painting.
Yes.
But equally, we have portraits then which are pure head and shoulders. And you're really just looking at the face of that person.
Yes.
And trying to get something of their personality and who they are inside from those portraits as well. So, and that could, again, that pertains to even how we portray ourselves in selfies or what our online image is in terms of what we use for our various social media. So, I mean, people, as a rule, have always been interested in portraiture, in portraying themselves or the people around them. And that's been happening since they could pick up a brush and make marks, really.
Sinead Rice of the National Gallery with Ryan. Now, have a listen to this. That was maybe 2 or 3 seconds of silence, an enormity in Radioland, enough to get people jumping for a filler CD or to check the antenna, and a powerful way to get attention. And silence was the subject of this week's lyric feature from pianist Guy Livingston. He spoke to Luis Rolo, an antenna engineer at the European Space Agency, and he works in a place called the Hertz Chamber, where no sound or radio waves are allowed in or out, creating perfect silence.
It's blue. It's all its walls are covered with blue pyramids with black tips. These pyramids are made of foam. They are urethane foam. They are cut into shape and then squeezed, and then put in a carbon loaded solution bath. And the fact that these walls are completely covered into these pyramids allow us to make measurements as if the antenna or the satellite would be in free space, meaning no reflections anywhere.
When the Hertz anechoic chamber was built in the 1990s, it was the largest one in Europe. It's 25 meters long, 16 meters wide, and 10 meters high. It's designed to keep out all radio waves. So between the walls is a metal grid, a so-called Faradic cage, which isolates the room from all Wi-Fi and radio signals. To give you an idea just how big the space is, the doors are 6 meters high. You could drive a trailer truck with a spacecraft on it straight into the room and park it in the middle.
Wow, that is so cool. So what does it feel like to be in the room?
You do feel when you go in, you do feel a certain difference in pressure in your ears. I have to say you get pretty much used to it after a while. Yes, it's very different from noise because noise is there and then silence is like the absence of something. That's how it feels at least. Silence is about the lack of reflections. Oh, this has so many philosophical.
Yeah,
it does.
That's what I like.
It has so much to it. Noise is a difficult one for us because it can mean so many different things. In electromagnetics, noise is generally it's not even an unwanted signal, so we call that an interference. But noise is more, you know, what's the smallest signal you can receive inside.
The silence in between, the lyric feature on Sunday. Now, I think we'd all hoped that the saga of Ray and his trials with the sourdough could be put to bed. But when he spoke to Colm O'Gorman of Amnesty International Ireland about his COVID habit of posting a daily recipe online, well, Ray's sourdough shortcomings were brought painfully back.
What recipe has got the best reaction?
Well, one of the ones that people have gone really big on has been a recipe I put up for a no-knead loaf of yeast bread. This is a fantastic loaf of bread that looks almost like a sourdough.
Right.
And is fairly foolproof and anybody can make it. And one of the lovely things about it, I've tweeted it up there and I think you guys have it as well. About this one is loads of people are lashing me back with pictures of these gorgeous crusty loaves of bread that look much more nicer than the one I made even at this point. So
Be very heartening, is it?
It's lovely. I mean, the whole idea of it really was...
Is it lovely, Colm? Really? Now, there are two ways to look at this interview. The kind and frankly most likely explanation is that, busy working day that he has, Colm O'Gorman hasn't heard Ray's torturous sourdough story. Entirely possible. Or a darker interpretation is that Colm knew full well Ray's dark night of the sourdough soul. You be the judge.
Baking is about putting the right combination of things into a bowl at the right time, in the right amounts, and then following the instructions.
Yeah, but then putting it in the fridge for half an hour and then rolling it and then putting it back in the fridge for another 25 minutes and then...
Here's what you need to do to make this loaf of bread. 400 grams of flour, and good luck trying to find strong flour because that can't be found anywhere in the country at the moment. So you can
is that what I need to do? Tone deaf, Colm. Tone deaf.
A tablespoon of sugar, a tablespoon of salt, and 360 mils of warm water. Mix the flour and the salt, put the water in a jug, add the sugar and the yeast. As soon as the yeast starts to froth up on top of it, that can take about 5 to 10 minutes, lash it into the bowl, mix it up. It'll be really wet and runny looking. Cover it in some cling film and leave it there for an hour. It'll double in size. In the meantime,
That proofing?
That's called proofing it, okay, which just means letting it rise, right? Okay, and it'll about double in size.
We all know full well, Ray, that you know that that is proofing.
In the meantime, warm up your oven to 220 degrees with a covered casserole dish in it.
A Dutch oven. They call them Dutch ovens as well.
Yeah, or a Pyrex dish.
Ray,
with a lid or
trying to claw back a little bit of dignity.
If you don't have one of those, you can even use a loaf and put a tin foil lid over the top of it.
Right.
After the hour, put a little bit of flour onto your work surface, turn out the...
And this is the point that I edit down all the recipe. Don't care.
Take the lid off for 15 minutes and you'll have the most extraordinary loaf of bread at the end. Literally, it's throw stuff into a bowl,
I'm going to try that tonight. I will. I think I have all those ingredients. So I'll see. Because meanwhile, I'm trying the sourdough starter according to Nevin Maguire. There's another 5 or 6 days in it before I can do anything with it. So I'll try that.
There's an awful lot of work there.
Is it now, Colm O'Gorman? Shocking amount of work. Is it cruel? Cruel man. And then, just when you thought it was over on Thursday, another Colm, actor Colm Meaney, came on the line.
I always cooked. I like to cook and all that. But again, the 15-year-old is doing the most. She's a baker and she's baking. She has her own sourdough starter and all that.
Is she there? I just need advice. I'm on my
serious?
I'm on my second one and it's not working out for me, Colm. I know this. It's very sad. It's very sad.
She's upstairs. She's supposed to be doing some schoolwork, but she might come down.
Yeah, and it's worked for her, has it?
Yeah. She's baked some really nice loaves. Yeah,
right.
Yeah. Come here. We're live on the radio on Ireland. So you have to be quick. this is Ray Darcy interviewing me, and he wants to know about sourdough starter.
Yeah.
What's the secret? Quick. Say hello.
Hello.
Hi, Ada. How are you?
This is Ada.
I'm okay.
How are you?
So.
I'm quite good.
Good. Yeah. Can you give me in a couple of sentences the secret to sourdough starter success, please?
Don't forget about it.
Oh, I think the chances of any of us ever forgetting about Ray's sourdough, well, slim to none. That's it for this week's playback. Thank you for listening. And let's finish with a song that takes baking very seriously indeed. Talk to you next week.
Spring was never waiting for us, girl. It ran one step ahead as we followed in the dance. Between the parted pages and we're pressed in love's hot fevered iron like a striped pair of pants. This park is melting in the dark, all the sweet green icing flowing down. Someone left the cake out in the rain. I don't think that I can take it, 'cause it took so long to bake it, and I'll never have that recipe again. I recall the yellow cotton dress foaming like a wave on the ground around your knees. The birds like tender babies in your hands, and the old man playing checkers by the trees. This park is melting in the dark, all the sweet green ice is flowing down. Someone left the cake out in the rain. I don't think that I can take it, 'cause it took so long to bake.